have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:35 in the afternoon of Wednesday, May 11th, 2009, and we have a quorum. Senator McGuire is here, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. Thank you, members, for making this happen. We have one bill before us. It's a fairly complex bill, but we are under the excellent tutelage of Senator Betty Davis's staffer, Linda Zog. This is SB 96. And we'll turn it over to you, Ms. Zog, for an overview of the bill. Please proceed.
Thank you. If I may, this is Senate Bill 96, an act related to non-payment of child support related to certain judicial and administrative orders for medical support of a child. Actually, the full title has changed just a little bit under the CS, however. The sponsor statement remains pretty much the same. You have been handed a second sponsor statement, which after a statement says B, capital B. We simply deleted one sentence at the end of the first paragraph.
This document that says sponsor statement with a B in the
correct.
In the next to the title?
Correct.
I have it, and I think the other committee members do as well. Thank you.
Okay. And if I may, I will simply read this into the record. In July of 2008, the federal government issued new medical support regulations that required states to have guidelines addressing how either or both parents will provide for a child's health care needs through accessible health insurance coverage, cash medical support, or both. Under the federal regulations, states must order either or both parents to purchase reasonably priced accessible health insurance coverage, provide cash medical support, or both. Cash medical support may be required in those cases where no reasonably priced health insurance coverage is accessible to the child. If a parent is ordered to pay cash medical support, the Child Support Services Division must enforce the ongoing cash medical support obligation as well as collect any cash medical support arrears. Failure to satisfy these mandates jeopardizes $17 million in federal funding for the state's child support program. This bill adds to existing law the authority for a tribunal to order either or both parents to pay cash medical support if warranted. In addition, the bill directs the division to review child support orders for modification on a federally mandated three-year cycle. The bill adds cash medical support to the definition of arrears and the definition of support orders, thereby enables the division to use its existing enforcement tools to collect a cash medical support obligation on behalf of the child. Finally, the bill removes the language limiting who may request the correction of a clerical mistake in an administrative order or request the vacation of an administrative order based upon a default income. This bill puts Alaska in compliance with federal requirements, as explained above. This bill will assure that Alaska's children receive the medical support to which they are entitled.
Thank you, Ms. Zog. Do you have further comments about the bill and its overview?
Senator, my understanding of the bill is that it simply brings us in line with federal mandates so that we can continue to receive the federal support on child support. And we actually have folks from the department that are probably better versed than I at answering the nuts and bolts of this.
Okay, and let me just ask if that includes someone who can take us through a sectional analysis. The bill, to walk us through the sections.
It is.
I saw this. I mean, no one's been prepared, but I want to, on the record, walk through each section and say this section does this, this section does that. That's what I had in mind. Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. Let's turn to either Mr. Maloney or Ms. Steinberg. Do either one of you want to volunteer to walk us through the bill?
Mr. Chairman, this is John Maloney. I'll make an attempt at it. I have Assistant Attorney General Stacy Steinberg here also, and so between the two of us, I think we can probably go through it.
That's fine. And just put yourself on the record. When Ms. Steinberg first chimes in, she should put herself on the record. And when you alternate voices, you have to let the record know who it is that's speaking, or else it's too confusing for the person that subsequently tries to type up these notes. So just, you know, precede your remarks by saying, this is Ms. Steinberg, or this is Mr. Maloney, if I'm being clear.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Maloney, and I'm the director of the Child Support Services Division. So we can go down this section. Section 1, that adds a reference to cash medical support to the crime of aiding and abetting the non-payment of child support in the second degree. Basically, this is to bring that criminal statute in to compliance with the fact that we're now going to have a cash medical support order. So it simply adds that to the other regular child support orders that can be prosecuted under that particular item.
Sure, and let me just ask a question about that. There will only be one child support order, is that correct? I mean, there's some references to this aspect of the order and that aspect, but there's just going to be one child support order, which may order many things, including medical support.
And that's correct.
A subsection of that is cash medical support.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. I think in probably 95% of the cases, there will be simply one order that's an umbrella order that has both the child support in it and the cash medical support. I believe there might be some areas where there would be just a cash medical support order, and it would be where there perhaps would be, because of certain issues, a zero child support order or a medical-only support order that addressed only medical.
And let me ask another question, that is, will this bill create a sort of an automatic increase in the existing orders that are out there, or is it something that will be added to future orders?
Mr. Chairman, it'll be added to future orders, but as orders that are out there are modified, it will be added to those orders also.
So do you foresee the division, you know, basically making, you know, some sort of an omnibus amendment motion to the orders that are on the books now?
Mr. Chairman, no, we do not. We would take those, and we've done this in the past when things have changed prospectively from a particular area. We actually wait, and the feds have bought off on this in a number of cases. We wait until someone brings a motion to modify that order, and then we include those in that new order.
And I guess one more question on this point from me, and that is, will this, you know, let's just say, for example, that a person's child support has been calculated $1,000 a month. Will the addition of this term mean that you're now going to pay $1,050 a month, or $1,100 a month, or will some part of that $1,000 now be directed towards, for example, cash medical support?
Mr. Chairman, no. It would be in addition to the order that's already, the order computed under Civil Rule 90.3 would still be there. The difference would be there would be a cash medical support order. If, as orders stand today, all the orders that are issued have a requirement for medical insurance to be provided if it's available at a reasonable cost to either of the parties. If that medical insurance is not reasonably available to either of the parties, one party, the other party, or both parties could be subject to paying an additional amount in child support.
And it's just a way to defray the cost that the state's incurring for providing insurance for the child.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct in most cases. It does that. It also provides to the custodial parent, in those cases where there is no insurance, it provides her actually, he or she actually, cash money to pay medical expenses.
And I said last question, but I guess I didn't mean it. One more question is does that money have to be spent on medical expenses, or is it simply support that we, you know, infer will be available when the time comes to fix a broken arm or, other medical issues?
Mr. Chairman, no. It would be the assumption it would be spent on that, but there's no way to actually enforce that. We've had that all through the years. We've had people wanting accountings of how child support is actually spent. And the courts have ruled on a number of occasions they can't do that. And basically, it will be assumed that you would use it for that, but it's not necessarily that you would.
Okay, those are my questions about Section 1. Any other questions from members of the committee? Don't see any. Go ahead and on to. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Yeah, just to clarify. So would this require someone to go out and get health insurance for their child?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski. Actually, orders right now require that. If it's reasonably available, it's required that the party provide medical insurance. If it's not reasonably available to them, and normally the reasonably available is it provided through an employer and is the cost reasonable, if it's not reasonably available, they're not required to get it. If, in fact, an individual does get medical insurance, then there's a credit or a debit, depending on which party gets it.
So is it go ahead,
what
Senator.
What more are we really adding to this? Under this, then
I'm going to take a stab at answering that, just so I can see if I understand what's going on. It sounds to me like we're reaching a middle ground. That is, right now, if you don't provide insurance because it's not available at a reasonable price, there's no contribution to the medical bills and expenses of the child. Is that right,
Mr. Chairman? That's true to an extent. There are some other parts of the statute that talk about uncovered medical expenses and splitting the cost of those. But basically, if there's no insurance in place and the custodial parent receives, in your example before, $1,000, that's $1,000 for child support. There's nothing additional until you get to this cash medical support that would provide any additional monies for medical expenses of any kind.
Does that answer your question, Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Maloney. We're now ready for Section 2.
Section 2 adds the Virgin Islands and Indian tribes to the definition of state in the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act statute that Alaska has.
Very good. Questions? I don't see any. Section 3.
Amends the order of support provision to include both parents, medical support, and insurance. And I think this is just a definition type thing where we put cash medical support into that particular statute and the or both in the statute.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Section 4 adds medical support to provisions authorizing the initiation of administrative action to establish a duty of support. And again, that's basically statute authorizing us to establish support. This allows us to establish that cash medical support order.
Go ahead.
Section 5, amends periodic review of support orders to require a three-year cycle of review. This is another federal requirement, and basically the three-year review, we review orders at the request of the parties. However, the federal requirement wants the orders reviewed at least once every 3 years. And so this simply inserts a section in there requiring us to do those within that three-year federal cycle.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Section 6, let's see, it deletes motion requirement for correcting an administrative mistake in a support order. And basically, the way that statute reads right now, the only person who could raise the question of a clerical order in a support order, in an administrative support order, was in fact the obligor. This changes it so that either party or the state itself finds a clerical error, they can administratively fix it.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, if anybody's aware of an error, that person should be able to fix it, or at least make a motion to fix it.
Right. Section 6.
Well, I'm sorry, we've got a question from Senator Wilikowski.
On the three-year cycle for review.
We're backing up one now to Section 5.
Not a problem.
How often, under the current requirement for periodic reviews, do courts just go ahead and calendar times in advance to review these? I mean, is this going to add significant burden to courts to do this?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, not really. Currently, what happens in most cases, and that's cases that are enforced through the division, people will come to us. Either party may come to us and ask for a review and a modification. And we talk about those things synonymously, but they actually are not. You review to see if a modification is justified, and then you make the modification. But basically, if the individual comes to us and asks for a modification, we will start the process of doing a modification. And unfortunately, the way we do it now, even if the modification was only, or review and modification was done 3 months ago, if they come to us and ask for another one, we will, in fact, start another modification. Basically, if it's an administrative order, we do the modification ourselves in-house. If it's a court order, we prepare the information, send it to the Attorney General's office, and they motion the court to do the modification.
Right, but do courts now, how often do they require periodic reviews? How often does the court on its own accord, sua sponte, go out and say, we want a review? I can't imagine it's very often, is it?
Through the chair to Senator Walikoski, not at all.
So now we're adding a three-year requirement. Now we're basically requiring the courts to go ahead and calendar 3 years down the road.
And no, actually, the requirement is for us to do the review.
And there's no fiscal note attached to that?
Through the chair, Senator Walker, no, there's not. That, right now, we do the fiscal reviews based on a request. I don't think the requests are going to change. If we get to the end of the third year, currently we have an automated system that maintains information on the income of individuals who have orders. And once a year, that computer system, in fact, goes through and checks each order to see if it appears to meet the qualifications for a modification. If it does, we, in fact, notify both parties that the order may qualify for a modification and leave it to them whether or not they want to do the modification or not. As long as we continue to do that, we probably meet our requirements for the three-year modification. The ones that we would probably be looking at would be orders that the state was a party to, and those we look at anyway. So actually, I seriously do not believe that there'll be a huge increase in workload because of it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maloney. On to, I think we're on Section 7.
Section 7 deletes a motion requiring vacating a support order that is based on the default amount. And again, this one is one where the current statute says upon motion of the obligor. And right now, the way this would be changed, we would simply want to be able to do it based on either our own or the obligor or the custodial parent's request.
Don't see any questions. Thank you. Oh, sorry. Senator Walikoski.
Yeah, I guess, I'm just wondering about the implications of that. If the agency comes out with a decision, do you expect this to be controversial? If you can just go ahead and change your own decisions without having to go to a court, I can imagine that the obligors are not going to be very happy about that.
Through the chair, Senator Walikoski, actually we do it now. The only option now is that the obligor must request that we do it. In most cases, I would say into the 90% category, the obligor would probably appreciate us doing this because normally what's going to happen is the order is actually going to go down because we did this based on some default amount. So it's not an actual based on the person's ability to pay, which the child support order should be based on. It's based on either Department of Labor statistics for gender and age within the state. We have some old ones out there that were based on the old AFDC needs. We have some that were sanction orders that were based on whatever the highest amount for that particular order could be at that particular time. Those are the type of orders that we're looking for. They're based on some amount other than the obligor's actual ability to pay an amount. And that's what doing the default does, is to set it at what the obligor's actual ability to pay is for that time.
Okay, thank you. I get it.
And just for the record, we've been joined by Senator Betty Davis. Welcome to the committee, Senator. And just so everyone who listens to this is clear, the obligor is the person who's shelling out child support, and the obligee is the person who's receiving it. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. We also refer to it as custodial parent and non-custodial parent. The statute, these particular ones tend to be the obligor obligee.
Very good. I think we're ready for Section 8.
Section 8 redefines arrearages for child support purposes, and basically that now includes the cash medical support.
Very good. I don't see any questions. Thank you.
Number 9 amends the definition of support to include cash medical support. I think that's self-explanatory. It just puts that payment of cash medical support in that definition.
Understood. Thank you.
Number 10 amends garnishment provisions to include insurance and cash medical support. Again, just bringing that statute in line to include the cash medical support. Section 11 amends the Alaska Native Family Assistance Program to include obligations for the cash medical support. So it just adds that cash medical support into the other types of support.
All right.
Section 12 provides an indirect court rule amendment to Civil Rule 90.3 Alaska rules for changes made in the bill, and that's to include the cash medical support in 90.3.
All right.
Section 13 makes bill changes applicable to child support action filed on or after the bill's effective date. It's self-explanatory. Section 14 authorizes the Department of Revenue to proceed to adopt regulations needed under the bill. We will adopt regulations to further finish out the cash medical support and medical support itself. Section 15 provides for conditional effect for the court rule amendment section only for two-thirds vote. That's the change of the court rule. Section 16 is just Section 14 effective immediately and July the 1st for an effective date.
Very good. Mr. Mallory, thank you. That was a good overview of the bill. I don't see any further questions from you, although I think it would be wise if you stood by to answer questions as they may come up during the testimony we're about to get.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We do have people signed up to testify. We have Eddie Brakes, Jessica Archibald, and Bob Loescher signed up to testify. Who wants to go first? Welcome to the committee, sir. I'm going to guess that you're Eddie Brakes.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Nice to see you this afternoon. Please put yourself on the record, state your affiliation, if any, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Hello, Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you. My name is Eddie Brakes. I am with the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida. I'm the 4D director for our tribal child support unit.
You said 4D?
I'm sorry. 4D is a part of the Social Security Act. It basically means child support.
Very good. Thank you.
Again, I am the 4D director for the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, and during my testimony, I will also refer to it as the Tribal Child Support Unit. That is the name of the department that I work for within employment and training at Tlingit and Haida, TCSU, Tribal Child Support Unit. I'm offering this testimony in support of SB 96, Section 2, Alaska Statutes 25.25.101, Section 19. Concerning changing the definition of state to include the Virgin Islands and an Indian tribe, which puts Alaska in compliance with federal regulations. Child support programs that receive federal funding under Title 4D of the Social Security Act are called Title 4D programs. In March of 2004, the final rule for tribal child support programs was published at 45 CFR 309. This rule provides regulations for tribes to receive federal funding to operate tribal 4D programs. The state of Alaska and the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida both operate federally funded and approved programs. Central Council of Tlingit and Haida does not receive any funding from the state to operate its child support program. In March of 2007, the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida received federal funding to operate a comprehensive 4D program. TCSU has been collaboratively working with the state of Alaska CSSD. CSSD has transferred for services approximately 700 child support cases to the tribe. Both CSSD and TCSU are working together to provide child support services. Federal regulations require states and tribes to work together and cooperate, providing one another the full range of services. These are available to all other 4D programs throughout the country. This amendment will assist the state and tribe in their ongoing collaborations. The Tribal Child Support Unit, the CSSD, and the Department of Law have been in monthly telephonic meetings working together towards the common goal of ensuring all children receive the critical financial and emotional support they deserve. It is important to note that every other state in the United States has adopted the federal definition of state to include an Indian tribe. According to the CSSD sponsor statement, SB 96 puts the state of Alaska, CSSD, in compliance with federal child support regulations and does not jeopardize $17 million in federal funding. In conclusion, Central Council Clinkett and Haida is in absolute support of the state of Alaska CSSD's efforts to be in compliance with the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act through the amending of the definition of state in SB 96. Both CSSD and the TCSU provides resources and opportunities to families to better the lives of Alaska children. Making sure the state of Alaska continues to receive federal funding for the child support program is in the best interest of all Alaska families and children. This concludes my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brakes. And let me ask you a question, and if you can't answer it, that's just totally fine. We'll turn to Mr. Maloney or Ms. Steinberg. But let me ask about that addition of the United States Virgin Islands and Indian Tribe. Is it fair to say that not adopting this language would by itself put $17 million of federal aid at risk?
Yeah, I've also brought my 4D attorney, my child support attorney for Central Council, Jesse Archibald,
okay.
and the chair of our Judiciary Committee, Bob Loescher.
Very good.
If you would not mind, may I defer the question?
That's absolutely Jesse. Appropriate. Why don't we have Ms. Archibald come up? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Put yourself on the record.
For the record, my name is Jesse Archibald. I'm the attorney for the Tribal Child Support Program. And if you could restate your question, please.
I was looking at Section 2, specifically the insertion of the language, the United States Virgin Islands on line 22, and then on line 24, we're inserting the language, an Indian tribe. And what I'm asking is whether if we failed to do that, if we, for whatever reason, didn't include those two items, whether we would be jeopardizing $17 million in federal aid.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Brake's statements that funding would be jeopardized was made with the understanding that he agreed with the sponsor statement language. The sponsor statement language for the bill did indicate that $17 million would be at risk. So the agency with personal knowledge as to the exact answer to that question would be CSSD and not the tribe.
Okay, then let's, if you would like, you have a statement prepared. We'll receive that. I'll put my question on hold until we pull them back up at the conclusion of the public testimony. How about that?
I was here primarily as a support backup person to answer questions, and I indicated that I would provide testimony, but only as needed to answer questions.
I understand completely. Thank you so much. Then is there anything else you want to tell the committee while you're in the hot seat?
Thank you.
Okay, welcome. It's nice to have you here. Thanks for showing up. Mr. Loescher, how about yourself? Maybe you can come forward. Welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Robert W. Loescher. I live at 10645 Misty Lane, Juneau, Alaska. I am a subcommittee chairman of State and Tribal Relations on the Tribal Judiciary Committee. The Tlingit Haida Central Council represents 27,000 tribal members enrolled, and we are tribally membership-based tribe. The president of our tribe, Bill Martin, and the executive council, have passed a resolution indicating their support for this provision in state legislation. We'd just like to go on record as endorsing this legislation and appreciate the efforts of this committee to deal with the broader issues of child support. And we think the legislation as a total package is very good legislation. We'd urge you to support it and move it forward.
Mr. Lusher, I want to thank you. You're a well-known, well-respected Tlingit leader. I'm appreciative of your taking time to come and speak to us here today in front of the committee. Questions for Mr. Lusher? I don't see any. Thank you, sir, again. Is there anyone else here in the room who'd like to testify about SB 96? Anybody else on the line who'd like to testify about SB 96? I don't hear or see anyone. Let's go ahead and close public testimony and turn back to either Ms. Steinberg or Mr. Malady. And we have an inquiry from Senator McGuire.
Well, actually, my apologies, Mr. Chairman. I thought we were referring to committee discussion. So, but as we go through it, I think the question that strikes me is when we talk about cash medical support, who is the decider of what medical support there is? And in other words, you know, there are all kinds of preventative medical supports that you can offer for children. There are all kinds of emergency medical support that I don't think you could argue about. But then there's a range in between. And certainly you can think of in your own family unit with you and your wife having raised your children together that there may or may not be disagreements about what is the appropriate and necessitated medical care in a child's life and at what point. And so I guess my concern or question, and I'd like to hear from both the tribal leaders here today as well as anyone else who's online from the department about how that decision will be made, because we're talking about criminal penalties here.
Who wants to step up and take a swing at the good senator's good question?
Chairman, this is John Malney.
Mr. Malney, go ahead.
Through the chair to Senator McGuire. Basically, this particular bill addresses only cash medical support, not actually any medical. It doesn't actually define anything as to what the medical support would be. It's simply a source of funding that can be used for medical. The parents would still be responsible for determining what medical procedures needed to be done at any given time. And the department wouldn't get involved in trying to establish those, just an amount.
So let me just maybe ask Senator McGuire's question another way. The CSED is not going to vet or veto or analyze the medical procedures that the custodial parent decides to engage in. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. We would not.
This is simply a mechanism to give that parent some cash support for those efforts, whatever they may be, from the obligor.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Senator, does that answer your question, or do you have a follow-up?
Sure, and thank you very much, John. I appreciate that the department would have a difficult time doing that, but it strikes me that the department may want to really think about the question I've asked and consider the implications of it, much in the way that we ended up going to a very formula-driven way of prescribing child support, arrived about from a lot of subjective decisions about what does it take to support a child's life. I mean, there are all kinds of lives that a child can have, and some cost more than others. So we have a very formula-driven method at arriving at that amount of money that a non-custodial parent pays, and when they don't pay, there are criminal penalties associated. In this instance, we're broadening that pie, those sets of obligations for which the non-custodial parent is obligated to, and again, associated criminal penalties. And my concern simply is that, you know, as you know, in your job, you see some parents who have had amicable separations away and are raising their children custodially and non-custodially in a way that relates, and others that are not. And certainly parents, even parents who retain joint custody or who live in the same family unit, have reasonable differences about what type of medical care is affordable, what kind of medical care is necessary. And it usually weighs out and against all of the other family needs that you have. So it might be nice to have that extra six-month dental cleaning, for example. But perhaps maybe once a year is what we get, because there are all kinds of other things that the family unit has to depend on to survive. And so my, you know, you think about the area of alternative medicine, chiropractic care, again, additional well baby or preventative exams that go off of the schedule that the state might issue. And if one parent who's the custodial parent submits that and says, as a matter of fact and course, that, you know, these payments have been made, you know, to the custodial, to the non-custodial parent, I just wonder, what is that threshold of money? How do you make that decision? And if you're saying that there's no vetting process, you can just start to see where the problems may arise. If there are medical payments expended on behalf of a child by one parent over and over and over again that might be outside the realm of the non-custodial parent's ability to provide. Pardon me. So I just wonder if any discussions have gone on to that end.
Through the chair, this is Stacey Steinberg. I'm the Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, and my section represents the Child Support Services Division, and we provide legal advice, and we also represent them in court. Senator McGuire, I think you have kind of a two-part question. One part of your question, I believe, deals with when if the custodial parent does incur some medical costs and goes through those decisions about what medical care the child will receive. There is a provision that that parent can go to court and ask for the other parent to pay the other half of the bill. Typically, uninsured medical costs are split 50-50. So there's that aspect of it, is that if the child did receive medical treatment, they can go to the court. If the other parent doesn't voluntarily pay for their portion of the health care, and child support orders do address uncovered medical expenses, how that should be split. The other part of your question, I believe, deals with, well, if you do have cash medical support, how do you come up with, well, how much is that cash medical support? And if I understood your question right, that's one thing that the agency would be doing through its regulations. What this provides is the authority from the legislature to say, yes, in our state, we're going to have cash medical support orders, and then through the agency, through its regulations, and also through the Civil Rule 90.3, to figure out, well, what is an appropriate amount of cash medical support. And it, that would also be very similar to 90.3, where it would be some type of formula.
Okay.
Does that answer your questions?
Yes, through the chair, it does. And you're absolutely right. That's what I'm talking about, is, you know, the cash medical support orders themselves. It's a bit, I consider it to be one of the more serious things that we do in the legislature when we pass policy measures that have associated criminal penalties and financial consequences that make the difference in people's lives. We have an obligation to really think through what that means. And some things sound good on paper, but when you carry them out, you know, they need closer analysis. And I appreciate that regulations will handle it, but oftentimes it's in the regulation themselves that you really start to drill down on those really delicate policy matters. So I would enjoy hearing more about it as we go through the process in terms of what the department is envisioning in that regulation and what kind of percentages we're talking about and dollars we're talking about. But yes, you've answered my question exactly. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Good inquiry. My question still is on the table regarding Section 2, and I guess what I'm trying to get at is, you know, there may be some people who see the word Indian tribe popping up in a state statute and who you know, that'll be something they focus on. And what I'm trying to do is make a record as to the necessity of the inclusion of that phrase and the financial consequences to the state for not doing so.
Mr. Chairman, this is John Maloney again.
Please go ahead.
I'll go ahead and try to answer the question. The child support program is a federally mandated, state-operated program. The federal government provides 66% of the funding for the program. And in order to secure the funding, the state has to comply with the requirements of Section 4D of the Social Security Act and federal regulations in 45 CFR 300 to 310. Failure to meet any of these requirements can put at risk the federal portion of the child support funding. This amount last year was a little over $17 million. Basically, the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act was in Alaska was enacted, a version of it, in 1995. In 1996, federal government came out with Congress passed legislation that mandated that the states adopt the Uniform Act to be able to continue to receive their federal funding. In Alaska's Uniform Family Support Act, the definitions did not include those two entities that were in the actual Uniform Act by the Uniform Commissioners. So that's what this bill would eliminate. By putting those back in, it meets that federal requirement that says you will adopt the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act as it was in 1996.
It sounds like your answer to my question is yes.
Mr. Chairman, you're correct.
Thank you. Senator McGuire has a question.
Thank you. So to that end, what have we lost in terms of dollars between that point where we failed to adopt the definition in the Interstate Act and now?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, as of now, nothing. The federal government has not penalized us up to this point. This is our attempt to bring this into compliance, which was just brought to our attention back around July or August, I believe it was.
Okay, and through the chair, if I might, this discussion will play out, as you know, and as it always does. And so if the phrase Indian tribe, if the description Indian tribe does not remain in the bill, my assumption is that you'll fight as hard as you have always done to continue to ascertain those federal resources irrespective of that, right?
Through the chair to Senator McGuire, yes, we will. Okay. However, we have, in this past period since we've been notified of this, we have requested some waivers on this particular point, and the federal government has said no. I suspect that their next move will be some type of a sanctioning letter requiring us to either do it or face that possibility of loss of the federal funding.
Okay, and through the chair, it'd be interesting to stay apprised on that. I think the question, and you're going to see this play out, Mr. Loeffler, you know as well, over and over and over again, I think in the coming years, in particular with this new administration, my understanding is Heather Kendall Miller and others are being considered for high-level posts within various departments, and there's going to be more of a federal move to say Indian tribes need to be in our statutes and need to be recognized. And I personally do not have a problem with that, per se. But I think the concern that you're going to see play out in the legislature and specifically here in the Senate Judiciary Committee and in the other bodies' Judiciary Committee is a question of, you know, of sovereignty and whether or not mentioning or describing Indian tribes as they exist in their form in their current format means a wholesale look at sovereignty of Indian country's existence and sovereignty of tribes. And so I think as this bill makes its way through and that discussion plays out, perhaps that's a place to really talk about why it's okay to have this here. I mean, this is a description of a fact. I mean, Indian tribes exist. They exist here in our state. They administer important social dollars and programs. They're an important part of Alaska's governing structure, but this mentioning of it in this particular statute to secure these dollars doesn't necessarily mean that it's part of an entire relook at whether or not Indian country exists or how tribes will have sovereignty or not in the state. So those are just things to consider.
It's a good and valid comment, and that's one of the reasons why this bill will be held over, just to give the committee some time to mull the changes we're making. Mr. Maloney, Ms. Steinberg, anything else you want to add to the discussion?
Mr. Chairman, John Maloney, not at this time.
Thank you. We have a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Just, I don't know if anyone online is able to speak about this, but does the governor support this bill? Or is there anyone in the room that can testify to
that? We have someone who's nodding their head. Someone we know.
And it's nice to have someone we know.
That's right.
Hi, for the record, my name is Ginger Blaisdell, and I'm the Admin Services Director for the Department of Revenue. And yes, the governor does support this bill. This is one that she was asked for legislative support in moving it through the committees and feels that it is important. Another point that might be helpful to you, Senator McGuire, is that I am currently working on an instructional memo, and the Department of Law is helping me with that. And it may include a letter of intent that clearly describes how the definition of Indian tribe would impact anything else in this state. And at this point, it does not impact anything other than clarifying Title 40. So, and I can provide that to you as soon as it's finalized.
We'll look for that, but that's helpful testimony. Thank you, Ms. Blaisdell.
Mm-hmm.
Further questions? I don't hear or see any. With that, thank you all for being here. I appreciate the help from you, Mr. Maloney, and you, Ms. Steinberg. We will hold this bill over until Monday. Let the committee members know I've had to cancel Friday's Judiciary Committee. And so with that, we are adjourned until next week.